Programming for KSVY is brought to you in part by
The Schoen Group, located in beautiful downtown Sonoma. The Schoen Group is affiliated with Sotheby's International Realty. Our goal is to be your realtor, consultants, and representative for many generations to come. For information and guidance regarding Wine Country Real Estate, you may contact us at 707-933-1515 or visit schoengroup.com.
The following show is brought to you in part by
Highway 12 Winery. Sonoma wines ranging from Sauvignon Blancs and Chardonnays to local reds such as the Mission Hardware Old Sonoma Red, with a tasting room located at 27 East Napa Street, Suite S. Hours, 11 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. daily. More information, 707-938-8815 or at highway12winery.com.
The Red Grape, located at 529 First Street West, across from the Plaza in Sonoma. The Red Grape features New Haven-style pizza with thin, crispy crust high-fired in a stone-lined pizza ovens. For more information, call them at 707-996-4103. Visit their website at theredgrape.com or find them on Facebook at The Red Grape.
Unicom Tax Services, located at 755 Broadway. For more information, you can call 707-343-1898 or you can visit their website at unicomtax.com.
The Sonoma Valley Visitors Bureau, the only spot to get a regional parks pass in the valley, reminding you to support local restaurants by ordering direct and picking up your food in person. For more information, visit sonomavalley.com or call 707-996-1090.
Sebastiani Theater, located on the Sonoma Plaza. The theater offers a year-round schedule of films, live music, comedy, magic, and theatrical performances. It is also available to rent for private events with seating for up to 320 guests. More at SebastianiTheater.com.
And now back to The Morning Show.
And we're back. It is The Morning Show, Monday morning, the 23rd of February. I'm Marcia May Cumber, your host here until 10 o'clock this morning. And we've got our next guest with us this morning, who I've been really excited to talk with, because this is a topic that's been beaten up in the past few years. And it's got a really fascinating history here. David B. Oppenheimer is a clinical professor of law at UC Berkeley and the director of the Berkeley Center on Comparative Equality and Anti-Discrimination Law. And he has a new book out, The Diversity Principle, The Story of a Transformative Idea. David, welcome to The Morning Show. Thank you for being here today.
Marcia, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So, as I was telling you during the break, I found it really fascinating that there is such a long history to diversity coming out of German universities. Had no idea about this. This has all led to, of course, modern civil rights law and contemporary policy debates that are out there. You've written a number of books on diversity, but this is kind of the first look at the history of diversity and why we, you know, and how it all came about and how it may hopefully become relevant to all of us again. So you take diversity back two centuries. What was the moment or the innovation that you had that made it take hold of as kind of a principle rather than just a social outcome that's out there?
Yeah, the year was 1810, and one of the great public figures of late 18th and early 19th century Germany, or Prussia, really, Wilhelm von Humboldt, who had been one of the leading scholars in Jena, which was the great Romantic university with Goethe, and had been a sort of a witness participant in the French Revolution, ran off to Paris as a 19-year-old as soon as the Bastille fell, and then was the German ambassador to the Vatican, and had written these really important works on philosophy and liberty. And he is asked to found a new public Prussian university. And he models it on nothing that had come before. He says, we need a university in which students and faculty work together in labs, in experiential education. And to make that most effective, we need to include everyone. So instead of just limiting this to Protestants, we're going to include Catholics and Jews, who otherwise would have been excluded.
Yeah.
And he says, this is because of the benefits, the educational benefits of diversity. Wow. And that's where our current understanding of the benefits of diversity really begins.
Right. It was a fascinating story, and he and his wife are such fascinating people in the story.
God. Yes, they have this polyamorous relationship. He invites her lovers to come and live with them. He says that if she would ever leave him, it would be a happy moment because he would know that she was leaving him because it was for greater happiness, and her happiness was all that mattered. An interesting point of view.
Yes, particularly for that time.
Yeah. He had, you know, his own sort of gender identity was something that he played with, asked women to call him sister. You know, just this remarkable. Yeah. Meanwhile, he's inventing the modern field of linguistics.
Right.
He's an incredibly important intellectual figure, and an incredibly important leader, who then, and here's the German story in a nutshell, lives the last years of his life in a sort of an exile at his home outside of Berlin, because he is so outspoken about anti-Semitism and critical of German and Prussian anti-Semitism that he's driven from public office.
Yeah, isn't that something?
Yeah, quite a remarkable character. But his work then finds its way to John Stuart Mill and Harriet Taylor Mill, and his comments on diversity become the epilogue of On Liberty, probably the most important book in the English language on the idea of liberty and the importance of liberty. And if you read it again today, you could almost call it On Liberty and Diversity, because I knew before I started this work that it was about diversity of viewpoint. I understood that. But what I hadn't appreciated is the way that the Mills tie viewpoint diversity to identity diversity. And when they talk about the importance of women being participants in society, and they talk about the importance of admitting Unitarians and Jews and Catholics to Oxford and Cambridge, and when they write about the problem of the unfair treatment of black people and the need for home rule in Ireland, they keep coming back to this idea that the only way to understand the views of others is to include others in your conversations.
If only we could get everyone to do that, but... you know, we're still holding out for a shift there. And David, I want to ask you, you were originally kind of a diversity skeptic. That may not quite be the right word, but initially. But I'm hoping for our listeners who haven't yet had a chance to tackle the book, particularly because it's released tomorrow. The Diversity Principle, The Story of a Transformative Idea, comes out tomorrow, everyone. Can you describe in a sentence or two, what is the Diversity Principle?
Thank you. Yes. The Diversity Principle is that when you bring together people with different backgrounds and experiences, including people of different ages and different religions and different races and ethnicities and genders, people who speak different languages, who've grown up in different cultures, and you put them together, they make better decisions. In a science lab, they make more significant discoveries. In a classroom, they generate more ideas. In a company, they make more money. And in government, they put forth more innovative public policies. It's a positive social good to bring together people who see themselves as different, people who are outsiders as well as insiders. And that idea has been with us since the early 19th century. But in the last 30 years, we have all this diversity science that empirically establishes the correctness of this theory, that shows us that diversity really does help us make better decisions.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate for a moment. And so one of the arguments out there, the war on diversity, people who are pushing back against it is to say, well, just because I'm a white person doesn't mean all white people have the same opinion, the same thoughts on the same subject, or that I can't look at this from the opposite point of view. I can, you know, look at matters. So why do we still need diversity of other peoples, of other nationalities, of other ethnic backgrounds? Play that game with me and tell me why it's not enough.
Well, let's start with the fact that, of course, white people, black people, people no matter how they identify in terms of race or gender or all kinds of other forms of identity, have lots and lots of different points of view. And just for one example, look at the Supreme Court, and you have Justice Thomas, and you have Justice Brown, and Justice Jackson, and they couldn't be further apart in their view of the world. But both of them bring to the court a perspective that is grounded in part in their experience of growing up black in America. Now, Justice Thomas, who I think is a very interesting judge, I'm a big fan of his decisions in civil procedure, which is a subject that I teach. But in any case, his decision in Black v. Virginia, a case involving the Ku Klux Klan burning a cross, and the 8 white members of the Supreme Court at that time all agreed that when the Klan burns a cross, it's a form of political speech. And Justice Thomas said, no, it's not a form of political speech. It is pure terrorism. It is intimidation. It's not political speech, and we shouldn't treat it that way. I think that came out of his experience as a black person growing up, where the meaning of the Klan burning a cross was just different than it was for the 8 white people on the court. But to go back to the basis of your question, we could theorize that as long as you have a large group of people with lots of different points of view, that you're going to get the diversity that you need. You know who addressed this? John Stuart Mill, in a wonderful speech to the students at St. Andrews, where he was the rector, said, it's not enough to take another person's point of view and try to defend it. You have to hear it from the lips of someone who believes it. And that's why we need people from different nationalities, from different religions, all participating in our classrooms. Empirically, we now know that to be true. Empirically, we know that when you have a group that is gender diverse, that is racially and ethnically diverse, that has people of different ages and different religions, they will come up with ideas that are more innovative, and they'll come up with more ideas compared to even a diverse group in the sense of having different viewpoints, but all of whom share some important sense of identity.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So as you were alluding to, and we're trying to work around, current debates about DEI can get pretty vicious, and we've seen lots of examples of them. You've been spending a lot of time, obviously, studying the history of DEI and how this has all evolved or devolved. What is something that you want the general public to understand about why this matters on beyond the current political situation and all that? What's one thing you really want to get across with this?
We live in the most successful democracy and the most successful economy in the history of humankind. And one of our great strengths is the diversity of our population. And I want people to realize that when we get through a very difficult political time that we're experiencing, at the other end, we have to find ways to build bridges to each other, and we have to find ways to be inclusive. And it may look different. It inevitably will look different than whatever we had in the past. But if we lose our support for our embrace of diversity, we will lose an enormous amount of our success as a nation and as a people. So if, you know, if one message, that would be my message.
Okay.
If I had a second message, it would be that this claim that diversity is just a form of discrimination against white men is, it's just wrong. That's not what it is. This is a theory and a policy of inclusiveness, not exclusion. And it's not about not including white men. It's about increasing the size of the pie, if you will. So it's not about saying, oh, let's take what white people have and redistribute it to someone else. Now, if you want to talk about redistribution of people who have tens or hundreds of billions of dollars and whether maybe they should pay taxes, I know that's a radical idea.
We just talked taxes with the last guest, so that's a big one too.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you mentioned that. But before you go, I want to make sure that folks can kind of draw a direct connection here. So let's talk a little bit about a specific example that you can think of where diversity directly made something better historically. Just pick something you'd like to mention, make sure people know before you have to go.
Sure. Well, our economy. President Trump last week was saying that our stock market has never been higher. And that's something to celebrate, although most of the gains are going to a very small group. But it does represent enormous wealth building. And that wealth building is connected to the fact that boards of directors and C-suites and management are becoming increasingly diverse. And, you know, we've been, the business schools have been studying this and teaching it for 30 years now, that opening the door to women and opening the door to people of color in running American businesses have been enormously successful. You know, Nobel Prizes, 71% of the Nobel Prizes ever awarded have gone to Americans.
Wow.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It's a big number.
Yes, it's an enormous number. It's an indication. Oh, and I read recently that in the hard sciences, the Nobel Prizes in the hard sciences, that I think the number was 41% went to Americans who were first-generation Americans.
Wow.
We continue to make ourselves over again and again and again as a strong nation with great science and great universities and this incredible economy through the power of diversity.
Amen. We've been talking with David B. Oppenheimer. He is a professor of law at UC Berkeley, but more importantly, he has a brand new book out tomorrow, available at booksellers everywhere. It's The Diversity Principle, the story of a transformative idea. And I gotta say, it's a real smooth reading. It's filled with fascinating stories you've never heard of before that are just really compelling to go through. So, David, thank you for your time this morning and the book. It's absolutely fascinating.
Marcia, thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you, David. Have a great day. Thanks.
You
Bye-bye.
Too.
Listeners, we're going to take a quick little break, and then we are going to be back with bestselling author Patricia McConnell right after this.
You've been listening to The Morning Show, sponsored by
Highway 12 Winery. More information, 707-938-8815 or at highway12winery.com.
The Red Grape, located at 529 First Street West, across from the Plaza in Sonoma.
Unicom Tax Services, located at 755 Broadway.
The Sonoma Valley Visitors Bureau. For more information, visit sonomavalley.com or call 707-996-1090.
Sebastiani Theater on the Sonoma Plaza, offering live shows and event rentals. More at sebastianitheater.com.
Programming for KSVY is brought to you in part by
The Schoen Group. For information and guidance regarding Wine Country Real Estate, you may contact us at 707-933-1515 or visit schoengroup.com.
This Health Moment is brought to you in part by Sonoma Valley Hospital.
One recent medical study concluded that our lifestyle choices contribute more to our state of health than do hereditary factors. In fact, lifestyle choices are the major factor in determining most people's health. This is a reminder that the decisions we make every day about diet, exercise, coping with stress, and even our communications with others have a powerful influence on our health and well-being. Let's remember to be self-aware and make good practices and healthy habits.
The historic Sebastiani Theater proudly presents Beyond the Rainbow, The Intersection of Pride, a documentary film by director Antonio Contreras. On Sunday, March 15th at 3 p.m., Beyond the Rainbow serves as both a tribute to the past and a call to action for the future, honoring the legacy of pride while reaffirming why pride still matters today. Doors open at 2:30, show starts at 3 o'clock with a discussion and panel with cast after the movie, and at 4 o'clock, meet and greet reception. Purchase tickets at SonomaValleyPride.com. Benefiting Sonoma Valley Pride, made possible in part by Out in the Vineyard, Wake Up Sonoma, and ML. Beyond the Rainbow, the intersection of pride.
See them walking hand in hand across the bridge at midnight.
And now back to The Morning Show.
Gonged back in at 9:23. I'm Marcia Maycumber, your host here until 10 o'clock this morning. And I have been waiting with bated breath to talk with our next guest because I've been so excited to talk to her about her techniques, about her brand new book, which is her first ever fiction book, and it happens to be a murder mystery. So it's a lot of fun to get to. Patricia McConnell, of course, is a best-selling author, renowned animal behaviorist, and somebody who has spent decades helping people actually understand their dogs, not just to love them, but to understand them. You might know her nonfiction classics like The Other End of the Leash and For the Love of a Dog. They've all shaped how millions of us think about animal behavior. But now, set in rural Wisconsin, she's got a new book that features a scientist sleuth who's got loads of empathy. And it starts off with a shot, which we'll learn a little bit more here about that. The brand new book is called Away to Me by Patricia McConnell. Of course, as I said, you might know her other books like The Other End of the Leash. Patricia, welcome to The Morning Show, Sonoma. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me. What fun.
So I'm really glad that you could be here this morning because I have loads of questions about jumping into your first ever murder mystery. And I should mention, you also had a longstanding Wisconsin NPR show on the radio as well. So lots of experience being on the air. What was it that was the spark that led to, you know, going from nonfiction to doing a fiction book? What just made you say, I want to try this. I have to give this a shot.
Well, in one sense, I got old.
That's an answer I have never heard, and I love the honesty.
I was over 70, and my reaction time was slower. Most of the work was with aggressive dogs, or quote, defensively aggressive dogs, perceived to be aggressive, usually fearful. And I didn't want to travel around the world giving talks anymore, but I loved the part of writing my nonfiction books that I loved the most doing, Marcia, were the scenes that I set up. Sort of start out, I'd write a little story, page and a half story, about that brought up some information I wanted to convey about dog behavior, our relationship with them. And so I just thought, what the heck? What if I just start sort of playing with writing something fiction-ish? And it was, I don't know how much of it was that, or how much of it was years ago being at a sheepdog trial in a beautiful, beautiful countryside. You thought you were in Scotland, green hills, gorgeous. But half a mile away, there was a firing range. And so people would go up to the post with their dog, and there'd be like, boom, or, you know. And yes. And I remember thinking, what if somebody got shot?
Right.
And then that was like, well, that's a good start to a mystery.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you just mentioned the key opening scene, a sheepdog trial. And I have to say, personally, my only experience with sheepdog trials probably was formed from seeing the movie Babe. Do you remember Babe, you know? And of course, the unique part there is it's the little pig Babe who is guiding the sheep around the course and into their little pen at the end, which is, of course, the whole point of this whole thing. But it's a fascinating setting. And this is where we meet our protagonist, Maddie McGowan. Tell us a little bit about Maddie. She owns a farm, but she hasn't lived in Wisconsin her whole life. It's actually new to her in like the last 5 to 7 years, right?
That's absolutely correct. Maddie left what she calls what happened in New Mexico. She doesn't really want to talk about. And she found a little farm. Farmhouse was decrepit. She calls it Lonely Owl Farm. She has sheep. She's an animal behaviorist. She has a working border collie who manages her farm.
Right.
But she also got into the sport of sheepdog.
Yeah.
Competition, sheepdog trials, they're called.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's, you know, very much a novice intermediate at that. And she, you know, Maddie is described well by the title of the book. You know, a way to me is actually a cue given to a sheepdog to go counterclockwise. But it also is a metaphor for Maddie. Because Maddie is get away, away.
Right.
Very, very, you know, she's living very sort of close to hand, right? She's clearly, you know, not sort of putting herself out there.
Right. She's not dating.
And as she discovers as the novel progresses, really, there's a relationship she's not getting that she wants. So Maddie is the perfect conflict of away to me.
Yes.
Go away, but come to me.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got a few other major characters that we meet during the film, during the book. Of course, there's her dogs. She has an array of them. Bo Peep, Clementine, and of course, the cats, Thelma and Louise, who live on the farm. First of all, it's a little unusual because she's living alone on, you know, a 40-acre farm. That's a little unusual, I think, for women of a somewhat young age. She's not a youngster, but she is in her 40s. So she's in the prime of her life, has chosen to live on her own. She has a good friend, Dorothy. Tell us a little bit about Dorothy. She plays a key role in this story as well.
I love Dorothy. Can you fall in love with your own characters? Is that, like, acceptable?
It's helpful. You have to spend a lot
of
time with them.
Dorothy is amalgam of two of my friends. Dorothy is a more experienced sheepdog handler. She does a lot of wild animal rescue. She's a wildlife rehab specialist. And she sort of takes Maddie a little bit under her wing and sort of helps her a little bit learn how to work her dog at sheepdog trials. Maddie has, as described, the face of a model and the mouth of a sailor. And she dresses beautifully. So most of us, I mean, I also have competed in sheepdog trials, and I could tell you, none of us care what we look like, right? It's like one of the times, like, you don't have to worry about, you just have to be warm. You have to have clothes to keep you from being drenched if it's raining.
Yes.
But like Dorothy, and my friend, similar to Dorothy, looks like came off a cover of a magazine. Beautiful clothing, beautiful makeup. And then I have another friend who shall remain nameless, who is a professional sheepdog trainer who has the mouth of a sailor, as do I on occasion in the privacy of my own farm. So Dorothy is sort of amalgam of those two people.
Okay. All right. So she's a fascinating addition to the story too, to me, because of her rehabbing. And of course, I do admire her being all, you know, well put together. We have some more people in there. And of course, the sad thing is the crack that rings out at the beginning happens to a good friend of Maddie's, who happens to be the victim. And this is very sad because he seems like he's such the great guy, really nice, knows dogs really, really well. In point of fact, he is one of the key people who introduced her to one of her current dogs that she has right now. And that leads us to one of the things that fascinates me about the book, which is you make Maddie, our protagonist here, also she's an applied animal behaviorist. She frequently meets with people who might have been told by the court, you rehabilitate your dog or else, because there's been some sort of an incident. Our listeners may not be familiar with what's that like, what those experiences are. You incorporate them into the book. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, maybe some of the cases from the book, or why you included some of the different cases? And they're not all court cases in the book, but they're all different circumstances and dogs with different personalities, as they all have different personalities. Tell us about that world.
Yeah, yes, indeed they do. And I'll address the first or the last question first, which is sort of what is, you know, why are they there? What is the purpose of these cases? And I will tell you, I've been asked actually by several, you know, in interviews, I've been asked by several people, it's like, was it your intention to illustrate what it's like to be an animal behaviorist? And my answer is no. I didn't even think of that. My intention was to write a good story. I wanted to write a story that's like the stories I have loved and admired all of my life, where it's 1 a.m. and I'm like, damn it.
Right. You have to keep turning the pages, but right?
Exactly. I can't stop reading. So that was my intention. But never having written fiction at all, much less a mystery novel, the basically write what you know became really important to me, because I know Southern Wisconsin. I know what it's like to live on a farm. I know what it's like to be an animal behaviorist. So I wanted, you know, I wanted people, you have to know who Maddie is. You have to know who your protagonist is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I needed to describe sort of how she spends her time and what she does in life. And of course, that would be seeing clients. And so I can tell you that all the clients are based on some kind of interaction I had as an applied animal behaviorist in my time working as a behaviorist. And by the way, just parenthetically, I've talked to so many people on podcasts, et cetera, who are who are either done by or listen to people who are also dog canine professionals. Mm-hmm. And they're so grateful. It's like nobody knows what our life is like. People tend to, you know, they come up to us in airports and say, oh, you're an animal behaviorist. And you can tell they imagine us running through fields of daisies with golden retriever puppies. When actually we're sitting in a little room with a devastated couple, right, who are sobbing or arguing, or there's a dog looking at us like we're prey.
Right? Yes, a little nerve-wracking.
So all of the cases that I describe, keeping client confidentiality, I was really careful about that, but they're all based on reality. Mm-hmm. Every single case is a case similar in many, many ways to a case that I saw from a dog through it. I saw two or three dogs who went through a two-story window in a thunderstorm, got cut up by the glass. I saw some dear, sweet men who were dear friends of each other, who had this sweet, huge, massive dog who was adorable to people, but really aggressive to other dogs. You know, all the cases are based on reality. That is,
yeah,
what you read is indeed the life of an animal behaviorist in terms of their cases.
Right. And you really get to know the dogs in here as well. But they're not exclusively the focus. This is a human murder mystery story. We're going to make this really clear. There isn't a dog who's the victim of the murder mystery. So for those who like are panicked about that, that is not what this is about. And that leads me to my next question, which is, do you have specific murder mystery authors that you've been real fans of through the years and that you were hoping in some way or another would kind of, you know, would emulate and come through your fingers and through the keyboard, if ever I was to write a murder mystery, I really admire so-and-so. Who are those authors?
Yes, absolutely. So I grew up with Agatha.
Of course.
One of the blurbs from Cy Montgomery, who was a fascinating, amazing woman and a brilliant writer, her comment about my book, Away to Me, was All Creatures Great and Small meets Agatha Christie. And yes. I was over the moon. I cannot tell you what joy that gave me. Yes. Absolutely. So many. Sarah Paretsky, Louise Penny. And lately, I am just obsessed with Lucy Foley.
Ah.
She is just brilliant. How she creates these plots. Because plotting is not something, obviously, writing nonfiction.
Right.
You know, plotting is pretty important in a murder mystery.
Yes, it is.
And that's something I really had to study and work on. A lot of wonderful reviewers, editors, et cetera, helped me out. But Lucy Foley, right now, I'm obsessed with her work now. I think she's just brilliant.
We've been talking with Patricia McConnell. She is author of the brand new book, Away to Me, which is her first ever murder mystery, first ever fiction book that's coming out. But we do need to let our sponsors have a word in edgewise. So we're going to take a quick break and then we're going to come back and talk some more with Tricia about other elements of the book right after this.
You've been listening to The Morning Show, sponsored by
Highway 12 Winery. More information, 707-938-8815. Or at highway12winery.com.
The Red Grape, located at 529 First Street West, across from the Plaza in Sonoma.
Unicom Tax Services, located at 755 Broadway.
The Sonoma Valley Visitors Bureau. For more information, visit sonomavalley.com or call 707-996-1090.
Sebastiani Theater on the Sonoma Plaza, offering live shows and event rentals. More at sebastianitheater.com.
Programming for KSVY is brought to you in part by
The Schoen Group. For information and guidance regarding Wine Country Real Estate, you may contact us at 707-933-1515 or visit schoengroup.com.
This health moment is brought to you in part by Sonoma Valley Hospital.
Our life is essentially the sum of our habits. What habits would you like to stop doing? What habits would you like to start? Make a short, realistic list. It takes about a month of consistent effort to adopt a new habit, so keep trying. As you successfully integrate wellness into your lifestyle, you will begin to feel the difference, if only slowly at first.
Well, it may not be Mardi Gras, but it's pretty damn close. Join Artscape for a night in the French Quarter. Step into a night of music, flavor, and fun on Saturday, March 14th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Alley Gallery in Sonoma. Enjoy New Orleans-inspired food, dessert, cocktails, live music by T. Luke, plus a silent auction and raffle, all supporting local community art programs. Tickets are available now. Bring your crew of four or more and get a special pricing. Celebrate, dance, and support the arts. Get tickets at artescapesonoma.com and find out more information. That's A Night in the French Quarter, Saturday, March 14th.
And now back to The Morning Show.
And we are back. It's The Morning Show at 9:40. I'm Marcia Maycumber, your host here for all of 20 more minutes. And we have been talking with Patricia McConnell. She is the author of the brand new book, It Releases Tomorrow, Away to Me. It's listed as a novel, Away to Me, but it's a murder mystery novel. There are no dogs that are murdered in this movie. This is a human murder mystery, and it's a page turner, because I absolutely would get to the end of a chapter and be like, I have to keep going, because, you know, radio host, I get an advanced copy. So, and it was absolutely compelling. And one of the things that I really wanted to talk to you about, Tricia, was the setting of rural Wisconsin. Of course, the write what you know. But a lot of people have never been beyond Milwaukee, a convention center. Maybe they've gone to the Wisconsin Dells, so they have a picture of people doing summer vacation on water skis. And frankly, the crowds that go to the Dells, or maybe they've been up to, you know, Baraboo and seen the circus and that kind of a thing. So they might have that experience. But the rolling hills and the beautiful countryside of Wisconsin are less well known. And you really draw it out in the book with your description of the rural countryside, the back roads, which are so beautiful. I certainly grew up visiting the many lakes, you know, 10,000 lakes, which is, I think, the tagline for Minnesota, not for Wisconsin, but there are at least 10,000 lakes.
We actually have more.
There you go.
We actually do. We just like everybody to know that.
Yes, it's just a beautiful part of the country. So talk about incorporating it and incorporating the rural countryside of Wisconsin and what you want people to know about Wisconsin.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for asking, because I grew up in Arizona, of all places. I lived on both coasts. I've lived all over this country, and I settled here after living here for a while and moving to Alaska, actually. I love it here. The thing about Wisconsin is it's basically the entire country almost in one state. There's no ocean, but there is a massive set of lakes that are so big they seem like oceans. I live in an area called the Driftless Area, which means the glacier did not come here 10,000 mm-hmm. years ago and flatten it. Mm-hmm. So it's hilly. It's beautiful. Southwest of here, there's a whole Driftless Area that's geologically just fascinating and very special. So it's a beautiful place. It's black and white in winter.
Yes, yes.
It's just sort of a cacophony of browns in November and March. And it's just a kaleidoscope of glorious color in spring and summer. It's a beautiful, beautiful place to live. And so it was really fun just to describe that setting, you know, partly because I love it, partly because I know it. But it's also, the thing is, Marcia, is it's very dramatic. This is a very dramatic place to live. This is the middle of February, and a week ago, there was a thunderstorm in the middle of the night that shook the house.
Wow.
There are ice storms that drop massive trees on your driveway or your car, or if you're really unlucky, your house. There are massive thunderstorms. There are blizzards. There are ice storms. There are torrential rains. It is a very dramatic place to live. Yeah. And I've lived in other places and it was like, does anything happen here? So it's a great place to put a drama, as are sheepdog trials, because sheepdog trials are competitions involving three species.
Yes.
And as you read in the book, there's some really dramatic face-offs between sheep, mm-hmm. who have heads like anvils, who are not anywhere near as stupid and helpless as people think. You know, a 130-pound, 150-pound you and a 35-pound dog can have a discussion, right?
Yeah.
400 yards away from you. And yes. You're there to help your dog and to get the sheep without being hurt. And that's one of the things that's really important to me. Good sheepdog trials are all about taking good care of the sheep. That's how border collies were developed and bred. It was the kindest, best, least stressful way to move sheep around in the hills of Scotland. Yeah. And so it's really important to me that the sheep are taken care of well. I have sheep here.
Yes.
I have Beyonce.
Beyonce is one of the dogs, in case people missed that reference.
Beyonce?
Yes.
Oh, Beyonce's a sheep.
That's right.
Yes. So on my farm, I have Beyonce, I have Lady Baba, I have Babana. Yeah. So I'm very, very fond of sheep. But a sheepdog trial, as is the weather in Wisconsin, are very dramatic, as are murder mysteries.
Yes. They're all very well fitting. And it's nice because folks here are quite familiar seeing sheep in the vineyards here. So they are often here as our woolly weeders, doing their job in a natural way, which is most appreciated. And it's, to me, the dog part is so fascinated when you talk in the book about their relationship with the sheep and how they have, you know, like you said, 135 pounds, you know, and going up, you know, and the dogs are so much smaller. There's a secret dialogue going on there to coax them to do what you want, which is part of what makes it so fascinating, and all the dog relationships in the story. So if we go back to the drama of the murder mystery, because the murder happens right at the outside of the book, and we're all left with the whodunit. And we're introduced one by one to each of these great characters, including Dorothy, the very stylish wildlife rehabber who's a good friend of Maddie, our protagonist. And then one by one, we're introduced to some other people. We're introduced to George's business partners, who train police dogs, and other sundry characters. You actually kind of worked and consulted with a little bit of a group of mystery writers and a little bit to help develop the idea. Talk a little bit about the process for you as a first-time mystery writer about, you know, facing these plot conundrums of how do you figure out who done it and why and give them viable motivations and all that. Can you talk about your process a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And let me just start, actually, let me preface it by saying, here's what I used to say a while ago. Writing bad fiction is easy, but writing good fiction is hard. Now what I say, having time to think about it, writing even bad fiction is hard. Writing good fiction is really hard. It really is, and I have so much more appreciation now, so much more for these brilliant books. You know, we were talking earlier about William Kent Kruger. He's one of Bryce's about mysteries in the Midwest, and his descriptions of the land are just brilliant and fabulous. I had so much help. I dedicated the book to a colleague and a friend, Kat Warren. Kat Warren has a best-selling New York Times bestseller, What the Dog Knows, memoir about her learning to train a scent detection dog. So she and I formed a writing group, basically. Mm-hmm. We still do. We talk once a month. We send each other our work, and we give each other feedback. I gathered together just a bunch of my great friends, really smart women who love to read and love mysteries. We called it the Driftless Area Mystery Writers Advisory Group. I made them tea and scones, and they would read early versions of the book and go like, well, that doesn't work. Well, that doesn't make sense. Well, what if this happened? Well, what if that happened? And then, of course, there's my agent, Jen Gates at Avidus, who's phenomenal. My editor, Wendy McCleary at Kensington, who's, you know, fabulous, and all kinds of friends and readers. So writing fiction, there should be like 20 names on most books of fiction, from what I now understand. I went to Madison Writers Studio. Mm-hmm. Susanna Daniel helped me with the book. I mean, so much help. And it becomes this wonderful support group. Everybody knows how hard it is.
Right.
And I never ran into anybody who was anything but helpful, who was so generous with their time. Yeah. It's lovely. It's really a lovely group mm-hmm. of people who, sort of, you know, when you're all facing really hard times, you get closer together.
Yes, yes, yeah.
And getting fiction published is, as my agent said at one point, getting any fiction published is a triumph.
Right, right. Yes, it's so challenging these days, and the book world has been upended over the last 20 years dramatically, really, really dramatically.
And we all need all the help we can get. I consider myself very, very lucky, very grateful.
Right. So one of the things I love about the book is, although it's a murder mystery of a human, and yes, there is blood involved. It, you know, somebody does get shot. So there's your Agatha Christie portion in there. This is not one of these deep blood and gore all the time kind of books. This is not a 10 Little Indians, everybody's getting knocked off. This is not that kind of an action murder mystery. Again, our protagonist is an applied animal behaviorist. And one of the things I really enjoy about the book that is a nod to your nonfiction is getting to know the dogs and the situations, the clients that Maddie chooses to work with, and the personalities of the dogs. And some of what I love was if you've got situations with your own dogs, people, this is something to chew on, because I don't think that anybody knows better than Patricia, like, an exact little lip move on a dog has this meaning, or, you know, when the ears go flat on a dog or on a horse. They have really specific meanings that are telling you, they're communicating with you, whether they know it or not. Talk about Cisco. Let's talk about Cisco. Cisco becomes adopted during the book by Maddie, the protagonist. He's kind of unusual. Tell us about Cisco.
Yeah, Cisco is a dog that Maddie McGowan agrees to foster from the local Humane Society. Cisco was found half dead by the side of a highway by one of the volunteers at the Humane Society and brought in, and he is in really bad shape. He's physically in really bad shape, and when he can rally his energy, he is defensively aggressive. He is a dangerous dog. He is a large German Shepherd, and the shelter is struggling. They are trying to save him. They are trying to get him to eat. They're trying to get him to drink. But he's also, every time somebody does just about anything, he can gather a little bit of strength and lunge towards them. I've seen a lot of dogs like that. He's so, you know, so much, quote, aggression, and I'm doing the finger quote thing right now. So much aggression is, it's defensive. It's 95% of it, dogs are just scared.
Yeah.
They're scared, and they're trapped. They don't have agency. They don't have autonomy. They don't have options. They can't call a lawyer. They can't, how do they protect themselves, right?
Yes.
And so Maddie knows that, and Maddie's able to read his face easily when she goes in, and is outside of his kennel and is watching him. And somebody else comes into the kennel area, and she sees, you know, his head sort of goes up, and she sees his face change. And it's so clear to her that his behavior is fear-based, that the corners of his mouth are pulled back, just like they are with frightened humans. We share a lot of facial expressions with dogs that seem to correlate with internal emotional states.
Yes.
So she knows he's scared. And she ends up fostering him, and drama ensues.
It certainly does. And we don't want to give away those little plot details. But another interesting little plot detail here is there's a little romantic subplot in here. Was this something that grew out of like group discussion, or you know, this is all new material for you as a nonfiction writer. So adding a little romance into the murder mystery is altogether something new. What was that experience like for you?
I have to tell you, I literally called a girlfriend and said, oh my God, I have to write a sex scene. What am I going to do? I was just completely freaking out. And I did. And I will tell you that, first of all, they're very tasteful because that's all I could do. I will admit to you that one of my favorite lines of the book is at one point there is a tiny bit of a romance going on, and there's a gentleman out on the farm with Maddie, and the line is something like, and then we melted down into the grass and did it right there in the grass while Jack ran back to the house in horror. Jack being the dog.
Yes.
And it got me a whole conversation of what do dogs think about us, you know?
Yes.
Anyway, right. That's a whole other topic. But I love writing some romance. And I'll tell you, the plan is to have a trilogy, Away to Me, Come By, and then That'll Do. And I'm already coming up with some new potential romantic stories.
Ah, fantastic. I'm so excited. And of course, you kind of took away my last question there, which was, are we going to see more and how long do we have to wait? So the answer is yes, we are going to get to see more. So I'm very excited to hear that. We've only got 10 seconds left. What would you like our listeners to know about Away to Me before you go?
I hope it's a really, really good story that allows them to live in a different world and escape into it and love being there.
All right. We've been talking with Patricia McConnell, author of the brand new book, Away to Me. It is in bookstores everywhere tomorrow. And it's a really compelling murder mystery. Patricia, thank you for your time this morning. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Thank you, Patricia. All right. Bye-bye. Listeners, thank you for being here this morning. Really appreciate your time. Simon Says Sports is coming up in just a few moments, so stay tuned for that. Go refill your coffee cup so you're all set to hear what Simon has to say. I, of course, will be back here next Monday morning for another edition of the Monday Morning Show. I hope you have a fantastic week. Keep dry. Looks like we're not going to have too much rain, but a little bit here and there. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye. Send it off in a letter to yourself. Ricky, don't lose that number. It's the only one you own. You might use it if you feel better. When you send it on.
WSVY Sonoma.
Programming for KSVY is brought to you in part by
The Schoen Group, located in beautiful downtown Sonoma. The Schoen Group is affiliated with Sotheby's International Realty. Our